Lecture 8, Nietzsche's Progeny.
A last lecture on Nietzsche is quite a challenge, since one of Nietzsche's arguments are there are no lasts. There are no last interpretations. There are no last desperate moments. In fact, it's a little remark about history that I might begin this so-called last lecture with, is that the spirit of danger and catastrophe we may feel ourselves in today is in a sense profoundly ahistorical. I have a feeling that in a certain way perhaps every moment of history has seemed to at least some of its participants to be a profound moment of danger. And certainly if one looks back over the trail of history, it's much easier to see its barbaric ruin than its rational progress. In any case, I'm going to try in this last lecture, which will not, as I've just systematically indicated, be a last lecture or last interpretation, to evoke again that postmodern space to which the text of Nietzsche leads us and try to move us a bit beyond that by discussing Nietzsche's progeny. Now, Nietzsche's progeny, as I said, is already for me a joke because Nietzsche had no legitimate children. He's had many illegitimate theoretical children. And in fact, I think that in a certain way, if Nietzsche's text is in any sense a success, and by that I mean given its paradoxical nature, it was written to fail, but in certain interesting ways. I think that if it's a success in any other stranger sense, it is in the multiple and bizarre progeny which have taken the text up, used it, misused it, abused it, twisted it, turned it in a thousand different interesting ways. And if I've succeeded in suggesting a few of those, I'll be more than happy to have so perverted something that was perverse to begin with. In any case, I'd like to close with a return to our postmodern scene and try to make a little clearer what I mean by that with something more than indirection. I've already indicated one of the things that marks off the postmodern situation from what might be called a modern situation is the televisual, telecommunicational network and the saturation of modes of information, surveillance, and control at a level and intensity where the quantity of them qualitatively changes the nature of our experience. That's as brief a way as I could describe the trajectory, that the very quantity of information, the very quantity of the images and their global scope, I mean bonanza all over the world, television, ubiquitous and so on, that their very quantitative enhancement has changed our situation in dramatic ways. And to give this very broad point away quickly, let me say this. If, for example, and this is to leave Nietzsche for a moment and discuss not one of his progeny, surely, although a certain bizarre reading of a kind of anarchistic Marx is the progeny of Nietzsche. That's odd since Marx wrote first, but nevertheless, why should parenthood be that linear kind of thing? Child, I don't know. Anyway, nevertheless, one of the ways I'd like to characterize this broadly will be to discuss a certain sort of overview Marx might take on the situation. One way to think of the 19th century is to think of the massive forces of production, like steam power, the factory, railways, and all of those massive new forces of production in the 19th century, among which one helped to create the very class to which I belong, the intelligentsia, namely the invention of mass ways of disseminating books, which create the possibility of mass markets of readers, and the possibility then to develop an expert culture of readers to talk to the other readers. See, there are conditions for the possibility of all of us being who we are and doing what we do, and sometimes they're as bloody and ordinary as economics. In this case, I'm trying to make the point that in the 19th century, these massive new forces of production, one of their primary things that they were directed at was replacing manual labor with mechanical labor. This is obvious, an obvious point. one of the big stories of the 19th century was the extent to which the new technologies developed by capital replaced in massive quantities, in massive amounts, manual labor with the labor of machines. It would have been unthinkable. The technological accomplishments of the 19th and early 20th century would have been unthinkable without that large transference. So in a certain way, to look at that transference in the 19th century, Nietzsche's century, I've argued that he was ahead of him ahead of his time and ahead of himself. In fact, maybe that's why he talked about it, the wanderer and his shadow, is that he thought in a certain way he had come in an untimely way. Well, maybe anything that's interesting may be untimely, I don't know. In any case, if we look at the 19th century that way, as that being at least one of the big stories, then certainly one of the big stories of the mid to late 20th century would be the incredible increase in the switch from technologies which concentrate on increasing the intensity and the power of manual labor to those which tend to replace mental, intellectual labor. By that I mean not just computers, but the whole array of devices intended to replace, for lack of a better word, human experience. Subjective human experience. Television is an instrument of production, in my opinion, designed, whether it was with this in mind or not, functioning, in any case, to replace, largely, subjective human experience. Computers, designed sometimes for the direct technical function of replacing intellectual experience. In other words, things like adding, multiplying, dividing, subtracting. Really difficult now to get a child in the second or third grade to bother to learn to do that, and for obvious reasons. They have three keys they know how to punch. Why should they do that with their minds? Why waste that labor? Well, I'm not saying that in a cynical way, because it's like asking, after you've built a steam engine, why you should take a toothpick and knock over a mountain instead of using a steam drill. You know, I'm not saying our children are wrong. Maybe they should say, well, geez, you know, you invented all this stuff to replace intellectual labor, now you're asking me to do that? Give me a break. I mean, it'd be like asking you in the early 19th century to knock over a mountain and forget those new steam drills. This replacement, however, of, as it were, the other part of the human equation, if we think of the human equation as being something about humans as embodied and then humans as intelligent and subjective and rational, then we will see that, as it were, the advance of society has tended to replace both the human attributes that belong to mechanical skills, manual skills, as well as to intellectual skills. One of the reasons we value sport so much now is that the replacement of the laboring body required for the development of our society can be vicariously enjoyed when we see Michael Jordan dunk. And we remember, quasi-nostalgically, the beauty and the pleasures of the body. Although, of course, now deferred into an image. Because the secret of a postmodern society is that everything that was directly lived has moved away into a representation or an image. Everything that was directly lived has moved away into a representation or an image. So that we, as it were, enjoy the vicarious pleasure of a flying body. We hear the jingle, be like Michael, be like Michael. We participate vicariously in the beauty of the body, but this time as an image, as an image. This is a different trajectory for culture. That people that come after this time will be different subjectivities, if we still want to use that word. It will be debatable. It will be debatable. Nietzsche still lived and wrote in a time when the problem of theology was the believer or the non-believer. How to respond to the non-believer. The problems in theology and philosophy today, when they're posed at their highest levels, are not the problems of believers and non-believers, but of humans and the non-human. You see, until you have a certain subjective framework, the issue of belief doesn't even arise. The issue arises about, are the people to whom we address ourselves still human? And then it will be interesting again to discuss gods, their powers, magic, mystery, murder in the rain, and so on, once we've determined the deeper question about whether a society that first replaces sort of physical labor and then later begins to replace mental labor as it progresses does not efface the human entirely. I've argued that it already has begun to move it away into a representation or into an image. Well, this possibility is the possibility of what I would like to call, in the spirit of Nietzsche, nihilism technologically realized. That's scarier than Nietzsche's nihilism as a form of belief which would bring an end to this atmosphere within which the world was still mendacious and magical. This would be the technological realization of nihilism. Let me try to make that clear to you by explaining something that I think we all will know as a familiar example. There are great apocalypse stories in the Bible has a pretty good apocalypse story, right? I think it's boom, Revelation, and certain preachers really like to do that one, and it's exciting, and there are riders and thunder. The fact that apocalypse was technologically achievable and that we could set up all the technical necessities for it is now very old news, isn't it? Am I wrong about that? Or isn't the fact that we have technologically achieved the ability to construct a real apocalypse? I'm not now talking about a biblical myth, but an apocalypse on a high order. I mean, we now that the Soviet Union's breaking up and that particular myth is fading into other myths and other stories and other narratives, this possibility may not seem as real, but it's important to see that people born into a culture in which apocalypse is now a technological possibility that will be carried out by faceless people in little silos and guys carrying little briefcases, punching little buttons, is an incredible distance from these intricately constructed myths in the Old Testament, in the New Testament. And it's a different kind of apocalypse because this one is a technological achievement. Similarly, I'm arguing that Nietzsche's nihilism was still a matter of the drying up of a certain kind of subjectivity and belief formation, and Nietzsche's hope was the creation of new ones, subjectivities, new radical autonomous subjectivities. And again, because he doesn't belong to the dogmatic tradition in philosophy, not necessarily or not at all, perhaps, subjectivities like his own. But a possibility that I think Nietzsche himself did not face was that nihilism, the belief in nothing, the will to nothingness, the end of subjectivity, of human powers, would itself become technologically realizable. So I hope that my example of the development of weapons of so-called mass destruction, which from our postmodern perspective, I've argued already, seems giddy and utopian. I mean, now we look back on that and we go see those old atomic war movies, And I've watched the audiences, and they just love the blow-up scenes. No kidding. They go, wow, boom, look at that. The trees are flat. And already to us, that's a nostalgic moment. It was perhaps our last chance to realize a decent end to our species, one that would have been worthy of it. Now we may just trod endlessly, solving one little technical adjustment after another to the finely tuned echo machines that we used to call our bodies. Someone asked me earlier, perhaps it was on a break or something, someone asked me about, what about the ecology movement? We live in an environment where its most famous spokesman is the McDonald's Corporation. I mean, the possibilities for radical subjectivities arising under these conditions become exceedingly bizarre. Now, you go, oh, well, this is too much. Okay, this is too postmodern. I'm lost now. Well, believe me, that again, the development in the late 20th century and the trajectory of it shouldn't be underestimated. It really shouldn't. And I don't want it to be necessarily, in fact, it cannot, because of other necessary conditions, be a moment of despair, since that's long over with. The example I gave of that was, we all know that existentialism, what we used to think Nietzsche was, right, an existentialist. Kierkegaard was an existentialist. Very shallow way to understand them, and that's been over a long time. Now, if you want an existentialist, as I said earlier, you'll see Bill and Ted's Bogus Adventure playing Twister with death. And that moment's over a long time ago. I even had a professor who said the only reason it ever was so big is that a lot of professors found it to be a very convenient way to meet people and so on. say, I've been worried about dying, so have I, and then you strike up a conversation. Like in one of Woody Allen's movies, the joke was, you know, can we go out Saturday night? And, no, I'm committing suicide on Friday. Woody Allen says, well, what about Thursday then? Oh. Well, clearly the technologies that are coming, and I'll mention a few of them, virtual reality suits. You go, well, oh, wow, nice, flipped, virtual reality suits. No, they were actually developed for a quite sensible reason. They were developed for long space flights back in the days when NASA thought they were going to go on long space flights. Now we understand that there's no need to, because we can go to Epcot Center and experience one, so we don't need it for the consuming public, but because we can already experience a long space flight at Epcot Center, just like we don't need to go to Switzerland anymore. We can go to Busch Gardens, where the Swiss food is even more Swiss, we can buy a Swiss clock, and we can avoid all the problems connected with travel. And experience Switzerland, you know. The thing is, I'm not even joking, because when you go to Switzerland, there'll be the same stuff, and McDonald's will be there too. And the television will be on the same channels, and the Holiday Inn will be open, and the room will look just like the one does here, and so on. This postmodern space is not a dream of theorists. It is becoming our culture and way of life. I'm just describing it. I don't even know how to denounce it. This is not a criticism. Some parts of it make me feel giddy and kind of excited, because virtual reality suits, if we let our imaginations go for a moment, could have endless, fascinating possibilities. Right? Right. Sure. I mean, you can... lots of things that human powers couldn't accomplish, right? In the 19th century, lots of things that couldn't be accomplished by human power were accomplished by steam power and so on. Well, maybe our imaginations are limited in that the machines we build now will be able to spur them on to accomplish incredible things in that way. But anyway, the virtual reality suits, I'll talk about them in just a minute, and then we'll get to them. Were created so that on a long space flight, our space traveler wouldn't become disoriented in space, but would be able to put on this suit and thus feel earthbound for a while to reorient himself or herself on their space flight. Well, now the virtual reality suit they're working on marketable versions. And that means ones that are cost-effective, which means that we're still living in relations of capital, because that means somebody wants to make a dollar, which is okay. So do I. So do you. There's no reason in recognizing a necessity, no matter how cruel the necessity is. You've got to recognize them sometimes. In any case, the virtual reality suits will be marketed, and they offer this interesting technological possibility. You've always wanted to go out with Mel Gibson or... let me make sure I don't commit a gender crime so I'll get everyone in. Mel Gibson or Kathleen Turner or any combination of men, women, animals, and or whatever necessary in order to avoid committing a sexist crime, gender crime up here. Whatever combination you imagine, since under these conditions of virtual reality, whatever transgressive gender you have, you'll be able to live it out perfectly, in a perfectly commodified way, with a virtual reality suit anyway. Well, you want to go out with Kathleen Turner, you just plug in and press the body heat module, and then the next thing you know, you're right in the screenplay, William Hurt's out, you're in, she walks at the door, it's all great. Now, that's a product we'll want to buy, many of us. It's a product we'll want to buy. The problem with this advancing culture is that is buying, just like in an earlier period of capital, when you bought the wage labor of someone to do the work for you. Now what we're buying are instruments and equipments that do the experiencing for us. That was a part of my critique of all these instant therapies, is to buy a life story for yourself immediately that can be swallowed painlessly, you know. And when you buy a virtual reality suit, or what I call virtual reality eyes, which is television, if you look at virtual reality, it provides you a prepackaged experience, one that is already coded for you. In other words, designed with your mind in mind. Now, if you want another way to check out this new emerging terrain, this nihilism realized, what you might call Nietzsche's nightmare squared, if you want to look at this, you might look at what advertisements go with what normal channel TV programming. So, for example, if you have the Cosby Show, you'll have advertising for upscale African-American families mixed with the younger, yuppie audience that it draws. 30-something, which is now off, mercifully. Hope I can say that without getting sued, because I'm sorry, I watched it, but I got whining. Whining got to me. Sorry, yeah, they're just whining. But in any case, the advertisements followed the story very closely. You know, you'd have a little moment when one of the characters would sort of wistfully stop whining and look around. And then the next thing you know, there'd be an ad for an Infiniti car. Sort of answers that need to overcome the wistful desire. Well, I'm wistful and I've whined, but if I was in my Infiniti, an Infiniti of automobiles, well, that's not just a way to get around, now, is it? You see, commodities are no longer just things of use. They've become part of what we are. And we need to recognize it. I mean, that's one of the lessons that I'm trying to drive home here today, is that if there will be battles over this new terrain and on it, many of them will be fought on the terrain itself. Television, radio, magazines. As I've called it, the obscenity of the saturated communicational culture. Saturated with information, obscenely oversaturated information up to your neck, beyond your elbows. Now, of course, I could be wrong about all this. Let me just stop and say that for a moment. This postmodern trajectory, I think, hasn't yet fully realized itself, and I could be wrong about the direction in which we're moving, and perhaps Nietzsche's nightmare won't come true. I don't know. I know that none of us is beyond surprising. I'm not a dogmatist. Really, I'm not. None of us are beyond surprising. For that, we're just not capable of so perfect an irony. And yet, none of us are capable of refusing to subject our occasional surprises to further analysis. For that, we are not nearly simple enough. So I could be wrong. I could be wrong. And whether I am or not, though, this is the nice part about an argument like this, whether I am or not, time will tell. Except that here, if it tells one thing, it won't have mattered, as you may have guessed, since it won't have told it to anyone. Since if I'm right, my argument has the peculiar characteristic that it will not have mattered. It will only have mattered if what I've said turns out to be wrong in ways that my argument has affected. Now I want to return from that current moment, the trajectory of the postmodern, back to Nietzsche for a second, since we're trying to end Nietzsche, and yet I see how impossible that is now. Perhaps we won't be through with the reading of Nietzsche. Perhaps even once the world has been fully turned into replicants, skin jobs, replicants, robotics, cybernetics, maybe then they will have a certain class of them programmed to interpret Nietzsche in ways yet unthinkable, right? Who knows? That certainly, why not? Well, I want to defend my general kind of descriptive procedure here briefly. One of the things that philosophers do as part of an anxiety complex is to try to prove they weren't wrong, so I'm going to do that very briefly. And I'm going to do it here by aligning myself with Nietzsche for at least a moment again, pulling back from the horror, I don't know if it's horror. Some postmodern theorists view it as ecstasy. At a certain level of pain and strangeness, it's difficult to distinguish the two anyway. That might be a remark only about my personal pathologies. I'm not sure. But in any case, Bertrand Russell once said, and I don't remember where, but it was an irritation over philosophers who cannot be refuted according to the normal rules of truth and falsity, and the empirical verification of their propositions, and so on. It was a very irritating thing to him. He named, among others, Nietzsche, Kierkegaard, and so on. And he thought that they were connected in some deep sense to the growth of unreason in the 19th and 20th century, which, from my view of history, is to get things backwards. I've always thought that this strange paleoconservative desire to blame intellectuals for things is odd. We talk about the Enlightenment, you know, loosely in universities, as though four pedants could make an age of the world. You notice I haven't given an analysis of the Enlightenment, but of modernity, of modernization, of the advance of capital, because four pedants don't make an age. And two or three weird philosophers don't give birth to a century of unreason. You know, Nietzsche didn't, you know, from his drawing room, give birth to a century of cannonade, slaughter, concentration camps, CIA subterfuge, raping and the murdering of nuns, the bombing of continents, the despoiling of beaches, and the ruining of a planet. Four or five pedants do not have that much power, and never have. That's just a sort of bugbear. They didn't unleash unreason on the world. Jeez, how crazy can some people get? I mean, even in the postmodern world, you shouldn't be that crazy to think three or four pedants invented this stuff. And don't think when I talk about the postmodern condition that three or four pedants invented that description. I mean, what makes these descriptions necessary is what goes on all around us and in our daily lives as we begin to feel distant from ourselves in bizarre ways. Nevertheless, Russell said, well, look, this unreasonable approach, he thought was connected to Hume's, as I've mentioned Hume before, to Hume's destruction of empiricism. What do you mean? Hume destroying the self and various other rational accounts. Russell thought the horrible consequence that followed from the multiplicity of interpretations, the many ways in which we can deploy the word truth, the shifting context in which we can interpret, the many narratives that we can tell. He thought the horrible consequence that followed from that was unreason. And by the way, I do like Russell in many respects. Don't get me wrong. Especially Russell as a person. Much more interesting person than Nietzsche as a person. Certainly had better politics as a person. But on this point, I disagree with Russell. Russell says, look, if there is no intellectual difference between sanity and insanity, I mean, he gets this extreme with it. Now, Russell usually doesn't talk that extremely. If there's no intellectual difference between sanity and insanity, reason and unreason, truth and falsity, well, then the lunatic who believes he is a poached egg is to be condemned solely on the ground that he is in the minority. This is a desperate point of view. And it must be hoped that in some way we can escape it. That's all Russell has to say about that point of view in his history of Western philosophy. That's all he has to say about it. Because acute man that he is and logician, he knows there is no reasonable and logical way to establish the authority of reason over unreason, to distinguish sanity from insanity. So it looks like what we're left with is what a culture comes up with to decide. That frightened Russell, and I have to admit that I have a bit of Russell's nostalgia. It would be nice if we could rely on something more than, you know, a majority feeling a certain way. Unfortunately, the negative force of my argument is this, is that those attempts have failed and been discredited utterly as a result of this, of our own culture and its development. We cannot, with reason, defend the distinction between reason and unreason. And that puts me in a strange position right now defending my analysis to the extent that I want to defend it. I will at least defend this much of what Russell says about it. It is a desperate point of view because it does put you in the position of saying to those who disagree with you that, well, geez, I don't think we're poached eggs. If someone, one of you afterwards perhaps says to me, I really am a poached egg. I'm so glad you mentioned Russell mentioning poached eggs because I've always felt like a poached egg. And you expect me to have a great argument, I may just say, well, I don't feel like a poached egg, and we'll take a brief survey around here and see how many other poached eggs there are. But imagine my embarrassment now to return to the postmodern condition. If I'm in a mall and I begin to feel like I'm in a loony bin, perhaps I'm not alone in feeling this way. I'm in a mall and I get what I call mall fever, where I just begin to look at the shoppers and the shopping frenzy and all the glass and the swirling, the twirling things, and I get mall fever and I have to get out, and I begin to feel like I'm a crazy man. And yet I have no ground on which to stand being in the minority in that feeling at that moment, because that passes for sanity. And that's what could be more sane than to spend some leisure time as opposed to free time, something we don't have any more of. Free time, leisure time. In the mall, I mean, that's sane. Why do I get mall fever? I must be crazy. Well, I mean, I can't defend myself any more than the person with reasons. Now, I can defend myself in other ways, but I can't with reasons any more than Russell could defend the distinction between insanity, madness, and reason with other reasons. Of course, that should have been obvious, and it would have been without perhaps some of the bad lessons that I have worked against in this course on Nietzsche, drawn from the dogmatic tradition of philosophy, which I really think have been a mistake. Namely, that if reason is to be anything, it better be my damn reasons you agree with. My reason. In this case, Western reason. Nothing could be harder after this little postmodern fable, if you want to consider it yet another fable, that's fine with me. Nothing could be harder than to distinguish that fable from its non-fable aspects, its real aspects. I mean, that's like asking the question in our culture about anything, whether it really occurred or not. And it can be something that's happened to you. And after you think about it a while and you've seen a few movies, and the best way you can remember it is through its similarity with the TVs and movies you've seen. And my conversation here has reflected how many movie and TV examples I've used. If that becomes the way in which you process your experience, issues like truth versus reason, reason versus madness, truth versus falsity, will simply fall away. They'll fall away because the anchor for those issues raised by Nietzsche was that very tension between what might be reasonable and what might be mad, what might be a truth that would be life-affirming for us, and what might be a lie that would not be good for us. Those distinctions will fall away. So I don't know how to put a happy twist on this story. In fact, I feel much in the position that William Gibson does in his magnificent novel, Neuromancer. I recommend it all to you. Gibson's novel, you know how many novels begin with sentences describing the sky and the landscape? So many. You know, it's just a standard novelistic beginning. Gibson begins his novel, Neuromancer, with the following sentence, and I consider it the best first sentence in 20th century American literature. I hate to even use the word literature about this stuff. The Neuromancer being a work of what I call near future fiction, a work that projects, as does the movie Blade Runner, the near future of possible social developments based on very close analysis of current trends. In any case, the first sentence of the novel goes like this. The sky above the port was the color of television, tuned to a dead channel. Marvelous. Sets the tone for an incredible book. Short, tough, interesting, brilliant. That sentence frames for me a description of sort of the postmodern trajectory. And to distance that sentence, and there is a massive distance, you could distance it from the sentences of Zarathustra, from the gay science. You could distance it from first sentences of novels such as Call Me Ishmael, Moby Dick. That's a pretty well-known first sentence in a novel, Call Me Ishmael, referring all the way backward to a biblical text and all the way forward to a new adventure, a new American adventure in living a life that would allow for difference and community, that would allow for freedom and the recognition of necessity. And that project ends, in my view, or at least the dawning of the end, if that makes sense, in Gibson, and in that wonderful first sentence. The sky above the port was the color of television, tuned to a dead channel. The fights that remain, the living antagonisms in our possibilities to construct ourselves in anything like free and autonomous ways, will have to be fought across that barren, strange landscape, that unthinkable cultural future of deferred and indifferent pseudo-experience. And across that terrain, the struggles for even moments of authentic lived experience, authentic in quotes, who knows, of lived experience to feel something, for God's sakes, anything, will be the locus of struggle and of action, we can hope. Here I'll call to your mind a scene from Blade Runner, where before the replicant dies, Roy Batty he slams his hand on a nail. And many of you may not know this, but when Batty does that in the film, it's a reference to an action that Sartre has a character perform in Roads to Freedom. In Roads to Freedom, the Sartre character slams his hand onto a nail to prove that he's free, because he chose to do it. It hurt like hell, but he chose it. Oop, I put my hand on that nail, and that shows I'm free, because just a calculus of deterministic pleasure, I would never have done it. So it's a philosophical demonstration, a painful and stupid one, in my opinion. But by the time we get to Blade Runner, the replicant slams his hand onto a nail just to feel anything. Just to feel anything. So don't worry about the communist or the capitalist. Fight to feel and live anything. Thank you. I have enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. We hope you have enjoyed the lectures on these tapes. To order more courses or to receive a copy of our most recent catalog, call 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12.